We turn again to the scriptures, to John chapter 20. And I'm reading verses 24 through 31. John 20, verses 24 to 31. Now Thomas, also known as Didymus, one of the 12, was not with the disciples when Jesus came. So the other disciples told him, "We have seen the Lord." But he said to them, "Unless I see the nail marks in his hands, and put my finger where the nails were, and put my hand into his side, I will not believe." A week later, his disciples were in the house again, and Thomas was with them. Though the doors were locked, Jesus came and stood among them and said, "Peace be with you." Then he said to Thomas, "Put your finger here. See my hands. Reach out your hand and put it into my side. Stop doubting and believe." Thomas said to him, "My Lord and my God." Then Jesus told him, "Because you have seen me, you have believed. Blessed are those who have not seen and yet have believed." Jesus performed many other signs in the presence of his disciples, which are not recorded in this book. But these are written that you may believe that Jesus is the Messiah, the Son of God, and that by believing you may have life in his name. A reading from the Gospel of John. It's interesting that we live in a world where truth seems to be relative. In other words, what's true for me may not be true for you. And that's kind of a sad situation when we think that the whole idea of truth in many ways has gone by the wayside in our generation. As a result of it, we're all faced with the task of determining what is true and what is false. All you got to do is watch CNN for an hour and you'll understand that you're trying to sort out what is actually coming to you as truth and what is actually fake news. But we often make our decisions based upon the source of the information or the integrity of the person sharing it. So a lot of times, because it's somebody that we respect and they tell us something, we accept it. Where we might not accept the same news or information from somebody that we don't know as well. There are times that we only believe what we have seen with our own eyes, and we refuse to accept what someone else has told us. Such is the case of the disciple Thomas, often referred to as the doubting Thomas. Now, it was after his resurrection, Jesus appeared to the disciples. There were only 10 of them at this point. Okay? Jesus appeared to them. Thomas wasn't there. Judas was already gone. And when the others told Thomas that Jesus was alive, he refused to believe it. Now, they were pretty credible witnesses. They were his friends. But yet, he refused to believe, saying, "Unless I see the nail marks in his hands and put my finger where the nails were and put my hand in his side, I will not believe it." Thomas appears to have been very careful in determining what he would believe. However, when Jesus appeared 8 days later, the scriptures tell us Thomas clearly believed when he saw the Lord, and he reacted by saying, "My Lord and my God." I've been reading a book lately called The Truth War. And in that book, there's a lot of discussion about the information that we're fed in our lifetimes. And the writer John MacArthur actually talks about the early church. And he says this: sometimes we think that the early church was pristine, pure, and untroubled by serious error. The truth is, it wasn't that way at all. From the very beginning, the enemies of truth launched an effort to infiltrate and confuse the people of God by mangling the truth and by blending lies with Christian doctrine. Attacks against the truth regularly came not only from persecutors on the outside of the church, but also from false teachers and professing believers within the church. So if we insert ourselves into the first century, during the time of Jesus' ministry, we would recognize that in this time of the establishment of the early church, that it was very much ordinary people who were selected, and very ordinary men who were selected as disciples to follow Jesus. Simon Peter, son of Zebedee, John, Andrew, and Philip were all fishermen. They all left their boats and their occupations to follow Jesus. Bartholomew, Thomas, James, Thaddeus, Simon the Zealot, and Judas Iscariot were six disciples that we don't know what their occupations were. And of course, the last one, Matthew, the hated tax collector, a despised outcast because of his dishonest career, because in those days the tax collectors pocketed an awful lot of what they took from the people. I've been thinking a lot about the world and the world's perspective on things. Maybe that's a sign of age. I don't know. When we get older, maybe those are the kinds of thoughts that come to us. But from a worldly perspective, and if those 12 men came through our doors, would we select them to lead our church? It's a legitimate question. Would we truly select them? 12 ordinary men who became extraordinary because of Jesus Christ. They didn't have written resumes, so we'd probably knock them out and say, "Well, you can't come here unless you can give us a resume." They probably didn't supply any references. Who would give them a reference? Their educational backgrounds were probably questionable. They probably only had one set of clothes and one pair of sandals. Compare that to us today. Yet we can say without reservation that the lives of these men were transformed by God's power. And they became powerful witnesses to the life and resurrection of Christ. You know, not one of them got a yearly bonus, even though they were on the executive committee. We live in a time of big bonuses. They didn't get any bonus. Their bonus was knowing the Lord. Paul understood fully how and why Jesus called people. In 1 Corinthians, he tells us this. Brothers, think of what you were when you were called. Not many of you were wise by human standards. Not many of you were influential. Not many of you were of noble birth. But God chose the foolish things of the world to shame the wise. God chose the weak things of the world to shame the strong. He chose the lowly things and the despised things and the things that are not to nullify the things that are, so that no one may boast before him. Were they perfect people? Are we perfect people? Not at all. The ones he called in the first century were ordinary people who displayed human weaknesses, the same kind of human weaknesses that we display. Think of Simon Peter, the beloved disciple, the one who the Roman Church calls the first pope. He disowned Jesus 3 times, then repented and went on to become a leader in the Jerusalem church. Think of John. I read 2 sections from his gospel today. What did he ask? He wanted to have a place of honor in Jesus' kingdom, but he was rebuffed for his attitude. He also, like Peter, became a leader in the Jerusalem church. Then there's the picture of Thomas. Absolutely not going to believe unless he can see the evidence for himself. He's disillusioned. You see a sense of possible resentment or bitterness in Thomas, because he knows the crucifixion has taken place. And even though Jesus has told him in the past that he's going to rise again, he doesn't believe it, no matter what's told to him. But I have to think that isn't Thomas a picture of each one of us on our Christian journeys? There are times when we get discouraged. There are times when we're disillusioned. There are times we have doubts. Should I be here or should I not? A week after expressing those great doubts, Thomas' faith was restored by the arrival of Jesus. And he's a changed man. I'm sure you can recall that on many occasions, Jesus told his disciples in advance that he would die and rise again on the 3rd day. But it didn't settle in here and in here. They didn't understand it. They couldn't believe that this was going to happen. When he was crucified, remember what the disciples did. The whole works of them got a new pair of Nikes and ran as fast as they could in the opposite direction. They ran. Doubt. Dealing with doubt. The disciples were trapped in fear and in doubt. They were anything but bold, despite being told that the resurrection would occur. They didn't even believe the testimony of eyewitnesses, even though the eyewitnesses were credible people. Luke records the apostles' reaction by saying, "These words appeared as nonsense, and they would not believe them. Consider the witnesses that were there. The women who were at the tomb were actually told by an angel that Jesus had risen. The women believed it, and they rushed to the apostles to share the news. Apostles wouldn't believe them. We also know that Jesus appeared to Mary Magdalene. And then there were the two men on the road to Emmaus. He appeared to them as well. And they only recognized him after they stopped to eat. So when Jesus showed up after his resurrection to the apostles, in Luke's account, not the account we read from John, but in Luke's account, Jesus said to them, "Why are you troubled? And why do doubts arise in your hearts?" Jesus calms their fears by saying, "Hey, settle down. Peace be with you." That's how he's trying to settle them in their fears. He then gives his first post-resurrection sermon. Maybe you'd call it a sermonette. And what does he say? And it's something he's saying to us. "As the Father has sent me, I also send you." This is the first declaration of the task of believers in the Christian church. A forerunner to the Great Commission that we know from Matthew 28. Jesus' command is simple, but it's profound. He's saying to them, "Go and do what I was doing." And that's what he says to us today. Our task, every one of us as believers, not just the old guy that's standing up here, but all of us, go and do what I was doing. The scriptures are very clear. The Father sent Jesus into the world for a purpose. It was not to bring about social justice, as some churches are preaching today. It was not to improve people's economic condition, as the great preachers of the prosperity gospel would tell us on TV. It was not to make people's circumstances better. Jesus' only purpose was salvation. No other purpose. The Father sent the Son to seek and save the lost. Period. He was called for salvation. He was called to come and make the sacrifice necessary in his death on a cross, and the triumph came because of his resurrection to bring salvation to all of God's people. As believers in 2018, we gather in this sanctuary this morning, and I submit to you that we have exactly the same mandate that was given to the apostles in the first century. If our Christianity is only 1 hour a week, then it's not worth much. But if it happens all week long, and if we are sharing our faith as we were called to do, then we are fulfilling the mandate that we're called to be. Jesus said himself, I have not come to call the righteous to repentance, but sinners. And in the high priestly prayer that I read this morning, Jesus said, your word is truth. I send them as a people sanctified in the truth, meaning knowledgeable of the truth, to do the very thing you sent me to do. That's our task, folks. So after 2,000 years, the spread of the gospel, the record of the scriptures, and the record of the eyewitness accounts, and the transformed lives over the centuries, there is conclusive evidence of Christ's resurrection. It should never be doubted, ever. There is so much evidence that doubt should never enter our minds. Everything we do, whether it's in our ministry, our worship, our study of Scripture, whether it's our spiritual testimony, as we shine as lights in the world, the objective is for us to display transformed lives, transformed by God through the gospel, so that the gospel has credibility when we proclaim its truth. When we fight, we lose all credibility. When we have splits in our churches, which have happened over the years, we lose all credibility. We are called to shine as lights in the world. It is notable in this day and age when we can't seem to settle on the truth that Jesus' closing words in John chapter 20, actually they were John's words, these are written so that you may believe that Jesus is the Christ, the Son of God, and that believing you may have life in His name. No greater words have ever been said. In 1998, an investigative journalist and trained lawyer by the name of Lee Strobel wrote a book entitled The Case for Christ. That's the movie you're going to watch tonight, if you come. The movie adaptation of the book, I haven't seen, but I have read the book upon which it was based. I encourage you to attend, especially if you have any doubts. Especially if you have any doubts about the Christian message. And I also encourage you to bring along friends, particularly if you think they're doubters or unbelievers. We're going to close by singing, Burdens Are Lifted at Calvary.